Is Stoicism past its due date as a mindset? The philosophy articulated by the embattled Marcus Aurelius as his personal life and empire threatened to collapse around him in 170 BC. It's over 2,000 years old, and we are now living in a world utterly inconceivable to even the most imaginative Roman aristocrat in the midst of a psychedelic Dionysian fever dream. Modernity seems architected to conflict directly with every facet of our evolutionary psychology and the philosophical values that have edified men and women for millennia. While new science, new thinking, and practice from the fields of biohacking and personal growth seem to offer pragmatic solutions in a world doing its damnedest to claw away our free will with digital talons, in a world utterly corrupted by politics, big business, big government, and devouring ideology, is Stoicism as a mindset an individualistic cope to keep your metaphorical hands off pitchforks that should be raised? That's the question I'll be exploring today with Will R. Young, a behavioral finance strategist, philosopher, top-performing supercaster in the Good Judgment Project, and the author of a new book that I just finished called The Enough Equation. And he's an avid surfer. He knows a thing or two about dodging shark fins. Hey, Will, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me on. This is lovely.
Okay, so yeah, let's dive into that big question. How is Stoicism applicable in modern life, both for the individual and potentially as a tool to make society more just?
Human nature has never changed. We now have communication, we write, we have phones in our hands, but the core is survival, and thinking is something that we have always done. It doesn't change. And when you reflect on how people act, when they have a mob in Rome, the mobs would scream and holler for the gladiators to get eaten by the lions. And that was a distraction from them having to think about what was really happening. We do the same things then as we do now. The difference is some things are speeded up. It's an ancient code. But the ancient code of distraction, hope, fear, greed, impatience, ignorance, those never change. Because with the palm of our hand, we have all the information in the world, yet so few people ever take the time to say, should I look that up to find out? They just trust some random person. And that's like when Socrates even asked somebody, what is courage? And one person would say, running into battle. And another person would say, standing up for people. Or feeding people, like we have different definitions. This is always the core of philosophy, is really understanding, hey, I make all of my judgments, making good judgments, having moral excellence, and of course, not allowing external things to bother you. It's no different than, you know, it's raining out. People still get mad if it's raining or snowing. They think it's ruined their day. It's the same back then. Nothing is changing the core fundamentals of how we think, because we're emotional creatures, I guess is what I'm alluding to. We're always getting emotionally fueled, and emotions do cause problems because oftentimes we're not thinking, we're reacting. And that may be great if we're trying to kick a ball in a soccer goal. We don't want to think about it. We want to train for that. But the training they did is very similar to how we train the mind. And that essentially is why Stoicism is so important and is the philosophy I prefer, even though I have some experience with the other ones. having a core basis of how to go through the logical steps and not allowing other people to ruin your life or your day are never going to change. We always have people talk bad about us, gossip. We always have people do things wrong to us. These are all human nature. That will never change. People will steal. They will cheat. They will lie. Politicians then lied. They distracted us with all the games back then. So it's the same stuff. Now we just go to football stadiums instead of gladiator stadiums to be distracted.
Or TikTok.
Oh, yes, TikTok. Yes. I guess TikTok would have since been probably going to the market and then just being a part of the gossip and watching the daily stuff. That's what we would have done. We would have went to the Agora, where you would go to the market and sit around and watch people and socialize. And now, you know, that was our TikTok because you had to. But people always wanted to gossip and talk. Oh, look at their clothes. Look how poor they look. Look how rich. That never changes. It's human nature. When we have magazines or now websites, I guess you could say, and the only thing they do is they show pictures of people and then have a little blurb and it grabs people's attention because that's what we are. We're always constantly chasing this short-term high in a world where we shouldn't. And I guess the market would be a place where you would see all kinds of people meet and that would you be your gossip. So I guess if that's answering your question, I think stoicism has never been more relevant because humans will never change because we are emotional creatures. We put our hand, you know, if someone tells us the stove is hot, a lot of people still test with their hand. You know what I mean? It's like we just often want to do things for ourselves. And I think having the ability to really reassess and think about how we act and what we do is so important. And that you can change your life and really map out a blueprint for living the best possible life so that when you die, you would have felt you have lived, truly lived, instead of just breathing air.
There was a guy in my audience that's really into stoicism, and I told him I was talking to you, and he introduced me to this concept of preferred indifference, which I had not heard of before. Is that, it can't be being indifferent to everything, right?
Apatheia is the third one. It's indifference to external events. Yes, of course, if you love somebody, you can be upset if they break your heart. But you can't allow the external events to dictate what happens, meaning in a relationship, yeah, of course, there are going to be things that happen. But we often have people get mad because someone's doing something bad to us. I can't get mad at every single person that dislikes me. I can't get mad because someone cheated me. Of course, there are exceptions in terms of love because we all seek love and we want a relationship. But a lot of people get mad. They get up in the morning, someone cut them off in traffic. They're mad about that. They're mad because it was the delay in the coffee line. They're letting all these tiny things get them upset. And there's nothing they can do about it. It was, you know, and it's the same in, there's a great graduation speech by David Foster Wallace called This is Water. And he talks about the same stuff. It's never going to change. We constantly allow all these things, the weather, it's hot, it's cold, I don't like it. This doesn't change. We are naturally wired oftentimes to complain. And there's nothing to really complain about because we can't change those. I can change the relationship we have. I can listen better. That's not an external event. If I'm not listening to you and I'm not treating you well, that's my fault. And I accept that. But I can't be mad because you're late because there was traffic or because you just found out bad news. Your friend has cancer. Getting mad at that is people do it all the time. And that's what we're talking about.
So preferred indifference is downstream from attentional control.
I guess if I'm understanding you correctly on the definition, it's just saying I'm not going to be upset about things that are completely out of my control. And Viktor Frankl talked about that. I couldn't get mad at every single person. All I could control was my attitude. I had to take accountability for what I could control and stop allowing external forces to ruin how I feel. It doesn't mean you don't feel and don't love. It just means you got to realize what is an external force and realize you can't do anything about it. Like, it's me getting mad at the ocean because the waves weren't great or they were too big. I can't do anything about that. Mm. When I'm in the ocean, that's you're powerless. You don't do, you have no control. And again, I just came back from a 2-week vacation. We had one day where, I mean, I caught the biggest wave of my life, like 7 feet, and it was awesome. But I also fell a lot, and I didn't get mad because I fell a lot. That's what happens. And then the next day, they had flat waves, so we had to go a lot further. I mean, it's just, that's how life is. It's constantly changing, and you're adapting.
Where did you go surfing? I'm curious.
Taramundo, which is in Costa Rica in the Blue Zone.
Ah, okay. I got a good story about surfing in Costa Rica, but I'll save that for the end of this podcast. There might be a stoicism takeaway from this story. I don't really know. Okay. So how would you apply stoicism to dating? Because single people are really struggling these days. The digital world has just created this incredible mismatch for people trying to find meaningful relationships. You can go on podcasts and you can listen to all the Red Pill podcasts about all of the problems with women these days. And then I'll also go on like Quora sometimes and I'll listen to women talking about trying to find a decent guy these days, trying to find a guy that will commit. Single people are really struggling. And that the dating, that is a difficult place to apply. I've been happily married for 7 years now, but that is a difficult place in life to figure out where to draw that line in between what you can control and what you really can't control.
That is a great question. Wow, that is powerful. And I will give you this because I am on online dating. I've had to make changes. And at the same time, I do understand exactly. Women generally make the decisions. Men in real life, women say they want to be met in real life. They prefer it. And they want a man to make the first move, but technically you have to rely on gaze or eye contact from them because they'll give you that, like, okay, like you can come over and approach me. That is probably the much better way to do it. We used to do it. We'd go up to people, we'd talk to them, and then you'd actually have the body language and the ability to communicate, which is how Stoicism was designed. It wasn't designed for an app where you're swiping right or swiping left, because you can go through 100 people quickly, and women are, I think it's like 10% of the men are swiped by like 90% of the women. So all of these men are not being swiped because they don't have the best picture, whereas in real life, women aren't necessarily going for just looks, they're going for many other things. So that can be very frustrating because if you don't have that top 10 picture, basically 90% of the men don't get swiped at all. And that can destroy your internal confidence, but it's not real because it's an illusory only because of the way the app is designed. And I think even for me personally, I mean, I'm older now, so I wasn't in my 20s, I'm 52. It may have been different. Maybe I've been in that top 10 per se. I don't know, but I'm not in that top 10 now because they'd be 25 to 30 roughly or whatever that age bracket is. And of course they would fit that. So for me, I had to reanalyze certain things and not take it personally, not allow the external events of, and I had to understand why people do what they do. So it is, and it can be very disheartening because, you know, 90% of men who want to find somebody can't because women are just swiping the guy with the abs and, you know, whatever it is. And that's essentially different.
The guy who's used AI to add the abs. Now, that's what they're competing with now.
Yeah. Or you're just, you know, a lot of women are chasing that specific age, and it is challenging. And I did have to change my pictures. I did have to make adjustments. That is one thing you do have to do. Your picture really matters. And I did hire someone to kind of tell me about this stuff, because I didn't want to have to learn the whole process again. I paid, I think it's Dating by Blaine, just to join a group, just to kind of get some understanding of how they really work. Because again, most of us don't want to become matchmaking gurus. We just want to get on the app for a month or two, meet somebody, you know what I mean? We don't, and then, you know, so you don't want to overthink things, but it is helpful because you realize it's not a reflection of you. It's a reflection of this really weird system that we're now in. So I think that's important.
I despise online dating. A couple years back, I wrote a book for men about courtship and
Sokarin.
And I really researched the online dating thing. And it is just so much more insidious. And when I coach guys in this area, I tell them, just get rid of those apps. Go to salsa classes, go to church, go out there and approach women in the real world, because there's just so many ways that those apps sabotage you and rob joy. And you, as you said, you're being... When I met my wife at a language exchange here in Sofia, she admitted to me later on that she didn't think I was the best looking guy. I'm not the best looking guy. I got kind of a funny eye. Okay. And, but she said, you had this really good energy to you. And then I told her the one thing about 45 seconds into our conversation, it just made her mine forever, which is, I told her I'm a writer and she's this voracious reader. And so that she became just very interested. And so when you're online dating, you're just getting judged within milliseconds based upon your photos. And that thing that you might say it a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes into the conversation that will hook her, you don't get that chance with online dating. So hopefully I've inspired you, Will, to maybe check out a salsa class, because those are golden. But let's get back into stoicism.
No, but we're 100% on that, because I think that was a really important point to bring up, because it is a tragedy how we meet people today. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because people really don't understand in real life is how we want to live our lives, not online. We cannot allow that. So thank you for bringing that up, because I think that really hits a lot of men, and men need that.
Okay. So your profession is as a financial planner for clients. How does stoicism fit into financial? Okay, I actually got a couple of questions in this one. How does stoicism fit into financial life? When is it the hardest to practice stoicism in one's financial life? And since I know this is your profession, and this is like your passion, this is your area of obsession, like, what are the unconventional hacks for stoicism in finance? What are the things that are like non-obvious about practicing stoicism in one's financial life?
Okay. The very first thing is understanding, what are your goals? And most people, when they invest, they have wild goals initially. They'll tell you things like, I want to make 15% a year, or I want to buy the next, you know, NVIDIA per se, or Bitcoin. They don't really know, just like most of us, we don't really know what our short-term, long-term, and intermediate goals are, because it's not something we've really sat down to research and look at. We spend more time looking at buying a car. We'll go crazy looking at cars, researching, drive them, do all this, but spend so little time actually educating ourselves on what would be a good life and writing that down. Stoicism talks about journaling. When you start to write down what you want, I'm going to go to Bali in a year. I want to travel every 3 months. Then you start defining how to invest in what you're investing for. What is your purpose? That is the very first thing, because if you do well and you make 10, 12% a year, which is phenomenal, and you hear about your neighbor doing 20%, oh, he bought weed stocks and stuff like that, or whatever that hot new thing is, the meme stocks, people then lose track of what their goals are and start chasing their neighbor. And that's called, I forgot it. Oh, God, I can't think of the name of the effect. The hedonic effect, I think it is people often start losing track. And Stoicism helps you define writing and paying attention to what is important for you and not chasing stuff, being thoughtful and deliberate in your actions. And again, when you have market corrections and market dynamics, not allowing them to bother you if you understand what your goals are, I think is, because people often want to sell right away as soon as the market goes down. They don't understand that Apple will be around in a year. They don't understand that Walmart will still sell food in a year. You know what I mean? Things like that that just seem so obvious.
Okay, so a lot of times, we humans really, and especially us men, we have an inclination to want to reward ourselves for hard work with toys that we'll have some, we'll have a goal or we'll have an accomplishment, and we'll say, I deserve some kind of toy for the, maybe it's a car, maybe it's a cool electronics thing, maybe it's a fabulous vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you have, as opposed to just picking a random toy to reward oneself, I bet you have a bit of a system dollar amounts, proportional dollar amounts that are like justifiable for a particular toy as a reward to stay motivated towards meaningful goals.
I guess that ebbs and flows, and over time, there are things that I work for now, which is more vacations than toys. I think we want, like a car may have been something nice when you're younger, but at this stage and through 15 years of Stoicism, a car is not like a reward for me or a bigger house. It's the experiences, and that's what I try to hit certain goals. And if I do, or when I do, then I try to reward myself through travel. I do travel very inexpensively because I use a point system. So I pretty much fly first class everywhere for free. And there are a couple minor things, and I share that with clients because I think they talk about this in Stoicism as well. You need to see the world. You need to take leisure time. And the word is skule. And that means leisure without study doesn't work. And traveling and seeing other people and learning about other things is really one of the great experiences. So to answer your question, travel is really something important. Occasionally I buy a surfboard, but I don't really have the high rewards anymore. I try to buy really good clothing I like and try to have things last. But my biggest rewards are just the travel, the trips, to get the experience. And meeting people is the reward. I've met so many amazing people over the past year. That's the reward for me now.
Aha. Okay. What would you tell to a younger guy, like a successful younger guy who, yeah, is going to like have that urge for toys?
Well, I would say, what are your goals? What is your income? And then also, what happens if you lose your job? This is something that happens. Like, I think we're going to go into a recession. I have a probability right now, I'm very concerned, of 75% chance of a recession. UBS said 93%. That's a pretty strong conviction. So the question with toys, and when we sit and talk about it, is can you afford that payment if something happens? Can you afford this type of stuff? Is it a need, want, or a wish? Because oftentimes we like those fancy cars, we lose our job, our credit. You could have a toy, and if you finance it or take it on, they could then become a major issue in terms of you not being able to afford it, because we have sudden changes in our lives. It could cause financial ruin, and then you lose your house, you lose your car, you have So there are things like that that I think it's really important to reduce the emotions of what your goals are. And of course, you want to work hard for something, but you also need to be prepared, because I think now more than ever, people change jobs a lot more and jobs are less likely to stick. And that is something that could really derail you, especially when you're young and you're trying to build your credit.
You're mentioning trends with recession, and yeah, that seems likely. Oh, I wanted to get your take on how one applies stoicism in the face of AI and technological unemployment that seems to, it was something that futurists have been warning about for about 15, 20 years. And it seems like it is really upon us now. And you, I have not looked up the specific job numbers on this, but I know that there's a number of professions now where more and more college graduates don't have jobs anymore because AI can do that better. And a lot of people, that seems like a difficult place to apply stoicism, because that is really troubling when we have invented something that is smarter than us in some ways, and we seem incapable of keeping up with it.
All right, this is a pretty intense question. The first thing I do, and this is where the super forecasting comes in to get a level head. If you look at what people have forecasted in the past and they're forecasting now, the first thing I would say is, what is the accuracy rate of your previous forecast? We've had millions and millions of forecasts. That I'll give you an example. When Excel was created, or I think it was initially Lotus 1-2-3, Microsoft bought them. It destroyed all the people that would do bookkeeping. Everybody, all the bookkeepers lost their jobs because you could just go on an Excel spreadsheet and do it. However, it created something called databases, which we hadn't thought of yet. And everyone knows what databases are now. Oracle and everybody, massive data collections. And so things that we could never do before opened up. So what's always happened is when we had the horse and buggy, and they're like, the cars are going to put all the horse and buggy people out of work. Then cars came about, and then you needed rubber tires, and then you needed more roads, and then you needed gas. Like, there are so many after effects of so many other things, but you still need real items. You still need, like, metal. You know, you need your phone. Like, there are things that you will never be replaced by that. And again, I guess it is possible, but we often predict the future with great inaccuracy. It's extremely difficult to do. And if you go 5 years out, almost no one can be accurate. 3 years is extremely difficult. And I would just say, what is your Breyer score? You know how people are. They have strong convictions. They sound great. Overconfident pundits, articulate incompetence, I call them, or hedgehogs. That's what I would look at. And so stoicism, keep us grounded. Don't allow the future fear to change us. Focus on today. And by focusing on today, but have an outlook in the future, you can stay grounded in reality, but be prepared for the eventual changes that are coming. Stoicism really talks, be present now, but also look ahead. Don't look back because you're not going back. Those are really important factors in that. And then keep your moral excellence so you really are focused on being the best possible version of yourself. And it is hard. You got to practice every day.
I remain pretty somewhat, I'd say I'm on balance optimistic on the AI topic, actually, because so with if we're talking about society in general, here's a better way to articulate this. The AI trend is like so many trends that we see in the world, where it's kind of bad for the person who is unthinking. For the agency person, it's negative for them, but for the life hacker, for the thoughtful person, for the person that's really able to interrogate their thoughts, for the person who practices nosweton, which is the Greek phrase for know thyself, I believe.
Yes.
For the more thoughtful, philosophical kind of person, for the person who's reading good books instead of on TikTok, it's a tool. It's a tool.
Correct.
That can be used to multiply the meaning and what you can accomplish in life. And if we're talking about society in general, society doesn't historically, I do not believe that society and civilization tends to get improved by the masses waking up to something. It tends to get improved by a very small minority of radical thinking people that really believe in what they're doing and who have some powerful, innovative kind of tool. And so I can see how I feel sorry for people losing their jobs out there, but I believe that a tool that powerful will ultimately serve a positive for all of us. But I guess we'll find that best set. That's a prediction.
Yes, we will. But when you do a prediction too, you got to put the time, you got to forecast, measure, revise, and repeat. And then you got to date it and assess for accuracy. Part of that is looking at the outside view. Most of the time we look at the inside view, meaning we're just looking really close, but we pull ourselves back. The number one thing that changes why people adapt technology is because the older folks die. And so everybody new coming into it, it's just normal. But the older folks fall off. So you had people fighting cars and just keep riding horses. People who didn't want air conditioning, didn't want a phone, they just die off. And then the new people, they woke up. And that's what the technology was. So it was never an issue. You always have just the normal cycle of human nature to not want to adapt. And then you have the other half, like you said, very radical, pushing like, it's coming, embrace it. I think it's called Moore's Law, where the changes that are coming are just going to continue to come. So the faster you adapt to it, the better off you are. And I think Stoicism takes that into account because there were radical changes with aqueducts and pools and, you know, they were the leader. And so there was radical changes. And you go to civilizations and they don't have bathhouses and they don't have hot springs and they don't have running water. Like, you know, there was change. I mean, Rome was way ahead of the rest of the world.
Okay, so we can get into some of my takeaways from your book here, which is a short book. I appreciate that. It makes all its points in, I think, under 100 pages. So it's nice. It's nice when people can be concise. The core argument seems to be that true wealth transcends mere monetary accumulation, focusing instead on emotional clarity, inner peace, and reclaiming freedom as one defines it. But okay, let me be a bit contrarian here. I have encountered more. Okay, I got a couple of friends who took that too far, I think. I can think of two guys that I'm good friends with. I've done podcasts with them. They're very erudite, intelligent men. And they kind of got too red-pilled. They, during like COVID, they got too sick of all the control and propaganda. And they said they went kind of extreme in the sovereign citizen direction, where they said, don't want to have anything to do with banks. Don't want to have anything to do with corporations. Don't want to have any contact at all with government regulation, anything. And one of them, he moved out to the wilderness and he moved into a tent. And it's actually a really nice tent. He showed me this tent, and it's like a nice warm tent. It's a really
okay.
Survivalist tent. Where he's doing a sharecropping. Yeah, he's doing sharecropping. He's doing pretty well for a guy living in a tent. But of course, no hope of girlfriend, wife, children. And then another friend of mine that I did a great podcast with a while back, and he got really into esoteric spirituality. He traveled around England, visiting all these sacred sites, and went really, really, really into the woo-woo and had some interesting things to say about it. But he gave up his flat. And I think he said he was sleeping in his car now. So I'm like, okay, I can respect some of the rebellious spirit that they saw injustice in the world. And they went as rebellious as they could. And they said, don't care about monetary accumulation. I'm just going to focus on emotional, spiritual clarity, inner peace, and reclaiming freedom as they define it. And now they're in a place where it's kind of turning into weird hermits. So I'm wondering, where is the balance to be found here?
That I think the initial goal is just to write down and realize what is truly yours. In 2008, the stock market wiped out people's wealth. There were people at Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, places like that, that had tens of millions of dollars, and then they were broke, you know, multiple houses. And then a year later, they had nothing, but they had tens of millions of dollars. And that can be taken away when it can seem like it's not possible. Look at the history of billionaires who were in the list and then are gone now. So much is determined by factors outside of what you control. And I guess the point I'm getting to is, once you realize your health, your wealth, the relationships you have, you're no longer chasing external validation on the monetary stuff. And then that's typically where we start to accumulate a massive amount of wealth. And then often we chase more wealth, which then we often do it on higher stakes, higher risk, because we've had success. And that often sets up for massive failure. People continue to leverage too much, do too much, and then it blows up on them and they lose everything. And I think that is where I'm really talking about things like, you bought the fancy car. This is a very common thing. They have a nice car, nice house, and they have no savings and no money because they're maxed out across the board. College tuition, school, they have nothing. But yet they have possessions, but they really have nothing. If they lose their job, everything crumbles. And I think that's what I'm trying to allude to, is what do you really need versus what are you trying to keep up with the neighbors for, so to speak? Because that's a very common thing I see people, and they have nothing saved, nothing left. That's why I think you need to understand what's really important. I don't need the car. I would prefer to spend a vacation with my family, sitting around, spending it with them, talking in real life, like we talked about, rather than just sending a gift card and stuff like that. I think that's what the core is. That relationship with sitting with my mother, watching a TV show 2 years ago. It was a hilarious Australian show. And I'll remember that for the rest of my life, because I hadn't watched TV with my mother and laughed like that in 35, 40 years. And that is so valuable to me now, that when she's gone, I will remember, because the women were so funny, Australian accent. And they often say things like cunt, which is a normal thing in Australia. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
And I was sitting with my mother going, it's not what you think, Mom. It's not what you think. It just means jerk. You know what I mean? And they're like, that's
or buddy. Or buddy.
Yeah. And they're saying, fag. And I'm like, that's a cigarette. They're not. It's just. And, you know, that's a memorable moment. That is a priceless event. But obviously it costs some money to get the place. But that's what I'm really focused on, because trying to keep up with the other people, you're never going to be satisfied. And once you write those down and you realize, I'm going to lose my mom, I'm going to lose my dad, I'm going to lose people. But now I'm focused on the real wealth of life, which is your health, your relationships. So that's really the core. Because money is not going to make us happy once we have enough to sustain our lives. It's oftentimes makes us unhappy. They're upset when the stock market goes down, and yet they're, I have people with millions of dollars who go, I feel poor. I'm like, you feel poor. And it's a feeling. And that's what I really want to go over with them. I want to get deeper into these stories to help unlock, you know, their mindset so they can open up to a different world that is a true world of wealth.
Do you, okay, I imagine you've dealt with some people that are kind of mindset hard cases that they, on paper, they do have, you know, but they feel a deep sense of lack and they seem kind of stuck in a rut. Do you recommend things like therapy, meditation, maybe a psychedelics trip in Peru for those kind of?
I've been to Peru to rescue dogs. Everybody always asks me that. I went and flew to Peru to rescue a bunch of dogs and brought them back. And one of the dogs is my
20 dogs.
No. Just three. But I was laughing because everybody, what you just said, everyone says, did you do ayahuasca? Did you do that? I'm like, no, I didn't go to the mountains. But what you just said is funny because that's a common thing. I met a lot of people on the plane that had done that. So thank you for taking me down that memory. To answer your question, the first thing is I always recommend talk to somebody, find a counselor, especially if you're older, you deal with a lot of grief. Losing friends, grief counselors can be helpful. There's no shame in that. Talk to somebody. Obviously, I can talk to them, but I can't be there in the same space and for them to help, because a lot of them are dealing with things that they don't want to tell you anyway. Maybe their son is or daughter is, you know, doing things they don't like or nag. And so there are things that people won't necessarily share with me that I will never be able to understand. But I do recommend people having someone to talk to. And nowadays you can talk to people, you know, visually like this and not have to leave your home, which is a tremendous value because a lot of people don't want to leave their house to see someone. Or they may be too far away, or they may move and had a good therapist. So I do recommend that. I think that is one of the benefits of remote work, so to speak.
So the book, what I liked about it is that it does some storytelling. It has a quick introduction by you, and then there's a parable of a successful man named Marcus, who experiences a galvanizing event in his life that makes him reconsider what he really values in life. And so, yeah, I thought that was kind of cool because storytelling is the most profound way that us humans absorb knowledge and wisdom. Let's see, a few things.
That's well said. Narratives are how people learn more than anything else is a great story.
Yeah. We all need to tell better stories. Well, okay. So a couple of things that jumped out at me was the parable emphasizes the supreme value of attention, which I brought up to you or I alluded to a little earlier. He describes dropping a coin that represents his attentional control. And right, noise is cheap, attention is expensive. I have spent too long on the wrong things. And for, because I'm a biohacker, I'm going to give people my best biohack for attention. Because in modernity, we all kind of have ADHD because of the just incredible hack that our smart technology and social media is for our attention. And if you want to control your attention, you need to bring 21st century tools to that fight. This would be a point where I would maybe say that stoicism is not quite enough. And the best tool that I have for attention is brain training. There is a brain training game that I use regularly. It's called Dual NBAC, and it's this brain training game. I'll play it for about, it takes about 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, and I'll play that a couple of times a week. And it's the most scientifically validated in clinical trials tool for increasing attentional control while at the same time decreasing emotional reactivity. So it's going to give anyone who plays it just a increased degree of like people call it iciness, where sometimes you don't need to be emotional. You need to be a bit icy. You need to be practicing that preferred indifference about things. And my personal experiences with Dual NBAC have validated what I read about it in scientific literature. There was a couple of years ago that my wife came to me and said, Jonathan, you kind of have an anger problem. And I kind of did have an anger problem. I would yell from time to time. Even a couple of plates got broke. And she said, this scares me. I don't like this. You need to make a change. And so I read a couple of books about anger management, and they told me things I mostly already knew. There was one book, I think it was by Seneca, and it said that anger puts a very high cost on small things. So that was because, I really...
That is so... You overweight little tiny things that really are meaningless in the long-term skew of things. Dinner was hot. Dinner was cold. Somebody was late. Okay, well, what does that have to do with tomorrow and the next day and the next day? Very little. But we overweight the smallest of things. God, that's a great quote. Yes.
So after my wife told me this, I got more disciplined about my Dual NBAC training. And that helped me with emotional reactivity. And no plates have been broken since. And even in this first 2 months of hectic new parenthood, I haven't yelled at baby, haven't yelled at her. So yeah, I think anger is something that I've mastered, and Dual NBAC really helped with that. So, and it's kind of like a mindful, like if people have tried meditation and meditation was challenging for them, Dual NBAC is exercise for your focus muscles. So that's kind of my hack for that.
Well, meditation is essentially, and now I can't speak to what you said, dual end, but
NBAC. Yes, that is going to be, that's going to be in the show notes for this podcast. So people can look it up.
And meditation, it works. And it's always been something that people just don't want to do because you have to sit still and your natural mind is to just drift to anything. And you could just be sitting at home. It didn't matter whether it was 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. You would come home. You would have thoughts just randomly pop in your mind, whether it's, hey, I got to cut the wheat. I got to take out the clothing. I got to go hunt. Like whatever, your mind was always active. And to shut it down takes practice. It is a muscle. Like you said, I can't speak to that, but I do it. And to sit there and just cleanse your mind is hard and it requires work. And I think that is really important to do. That is something that we've always needed to do, but people don't. And if it's easier to use dual end back, then that's great. Because we want to make it easier for people to focus, not harder. And meditation takes quite a bit of time. And a lot of people wind up quitting because, you know, they don't get it popped up on their calendar. If you put it on your calendar, you're more likely to do it. And then I would also recommend having a set time to do it, which I think you would agree. You probably do it at a set time every time. So that way you can have that time dedicated to it.
Yeah, you should. Mornings usually.
Your calendar is the autobiography of your life. And it's the truest thing that you'll have. So putting it on your calendar is you're more likely to do it. And I think that's why journaling is so important. I'm going to write at 8 o'clock every night. I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. and do this. I do 10 minutes of meditation every morning and I just do it. And then it's just done. And I'm like, I can't wait to get these 10 minutes over and not think. Like, that's how I think. And then once it's done, you're like, I'm so glad I did it. And I think that's the joy of being able to focus more, being really attentive to, I'm looking right at you. I'm listening to understand. I'm not listening to reply.
Okay. Next, in the book, you have there's a metaphor for flow versus control, which is that Marcus noticed the imperfections, a cracked bench, a bent fence, a vine tangled in a corner, but nothing felt broken. Everything felt allowed. And he concludes, risk is not the enemy. My illusion of control is. But again, I question here, we need control of, or okay, so I should be honest, I am pretty biased towards control, because the world can be a vicious, cruel, entropic place. And I have, in my life, the more I have applied control in expanding domains, the better things have been. My wife and I have a more traditional kind of dynamic where I am making a lot of like the significant kinds of decisions. And that puts a duty on my shoulders to like research things and to make damn sure that I'm making good decisions for my family. So I'm kind of a fan of more control over life. Although I try to engage in embracing flow by doing. Like I do breath work sessions where I focus physiologically on letting go, exhalation, and imagine and letting go of control so that I don't just turn into a tyrannical control freak. Do you got a hack for discerning that flow versus control dynamic?
Well, this is where I use my mental models. I listen for whatever claim. I'm listening to your control. I like control too. Don't get me wrong. However, our definition has to be clearly defined. Can you control, you make an investment, let's say in Apple stock, and then you get some bad news. You don't have control over that bad news. So what you're really talking about is the decision to buy the stock and then under duress hold the stock. You're not really, you have no control of external forces. The global 8 billion people on this earth, you had no control over the weather, the hurricanes, events such as an attack when Russia invaded Ukraine. And then the next thing you know, you have the US Treasury getting downgraded. Like these are things that, so those are completely out of my control. I can then control my decisions under those stressors. So that's where I think we are in agreement. It's just you have to define all these things. So much is outside of your control that you have to know what is outside your control, so you don't allow it to bug. So I've been hit. I've had people hit me in a car, and that was outside of my control. There's nothing I could have done. And I don't particularly like to drive, but if I did like to drive, I'd say, I like to drive. I'm going to be in control. But you're really never in control because there's other people moving around you. You think you're in control. It's an illusion of control. But you have millions of cars you're going to pass by in your lifetime. There's a lot out of your control. And so understanding, okay, I can drive safe. I can wear my seatbelt. I can make sure I have airbags in my, like, that's in your control. But the other people outside. So I understand what you're saying, but writing down and defining what is in your control, because buying in the stock market, I can't control a CEO stealing money. And I can assure you they do it all the time. And it doesn't mean I made a bad decision, but now I have to reassess the information I have now to make a decision based on that. I generally look for that type of stuff to make event-driven decisions. When Wells Fargo, the CEO, stole everybody's money, I don't know if you remember that, about 5 years ago, they did a scandal where they opened millions and millions of accounts in people's names that weren't legitimate. So he got a $250 million bonus. And a lot of people were running from the bank. I looked at that as if they do the right thing and they fire this guy, which they should, and claw back his pay, they can rebuild trust. So, you know, again, I had the control to buy it and other people had lost control to sell it. But the outside scope of most of the world is out of our control. Most of the world is out of our control. You're not going to change. You can't change a lot of the health that comes to you because of heredity, but you can change how you do things. So there's a mix. So understanding that, you know what I mean? If cancer's in your family, you can't change that, but you can eat healthier and eat more lettuce and eat more organic foods and stuff like that, I guess. This is where you at?
Stay.
Yeah. Yes. I fast too. It is.
Okay. Right on. Yeah. Yeah. If you fast, you don't, there's someone who I'm not going to name, but there's someone who I love who is really, really worried about cancer. Him and his wife are because of family history.
Correct.
And this is one of the factors that's compelled them to not have children, is they're worried that they have cancer genes that they're going to pass on to their children. And I wish this was a person that I could convince that the solution to this is not this genetic fatalism, but it's to educate themselves on how to prevent cancer and then apply those things stringently.
Well, so there's two things. One, so much is out of your control. You don't know if a doctor's having a bad day when you go into, but you can control seeing multiple specialists to make sure you get the right. So there's these. You're constantly in and out of control. And then you hope everybody down line does the right job. I lost my large intestine and I had like seven doctors misdiagnose me. When
it's my event.
Yes. Yes. So you're there and you're like, what the heck is going on? Are they blind or am I at the hospital or did I show up at the butcher shop? So there are a lot of, you know what I mean? There's things that are in and out. Eventually, my ex-father-in-law, who was a neurosurgeon, is the one who saved me. And I tell that because, you know, you're getting frustrated because you're not getting the advice to help you. But at the same time, you're continually exerting control on the things you can. But with cancer, you can't be afraid to die because we're all going to die. Inevitable. And you might die at 60 or you might die at 80, but we're going to die. And the question is living that full life. I think that's what stoicism pushes. Like, you may not get it. And then the breakthroughs that are happening right now will continue to be amazing. Like you said, AI may be operating on you and they might diagnose cancer because they can work all these formulas out faster and do all the testing. So there's so many things that you brought up that we're not necessarily talking about, as in they might start coming up with all kinds of cancer diagnoses in 5 years
And people would have said, well, maybe, but now they're doing it. So again, we're opening up more conversations. So I would not want to not live because there are so many things that you could regret at 60 and say, I wish I would have had kids because they came out with cancer and this and that and everything else.
Yeah, that'd be a tough regret too.
That would be a tough regret. Yeah.
Okay. So the book has some essays at the end, and there's a real good exercise in one of the essays that I'm going to touch on, that I'm going to share before we... I'm going to ask you about the Good Judgment Project and then Surfing Story. Okay, so this jumped out at me is how to define your enough. You write, most people have no idea what enough means for them. And I read that and I said, that's a good point. I haven't really defined that myself. I know I have kind of a vague dream that I'd like to buy a nice house by the Black Sea seaside here in Bulgaria. Yeah, I've got...
Oh, nice.
I've got that dream, and then maybe I'd like to get the same kind of Lexus I had when I was a young man, but I've really failed to do much more definition than that. So in your book, you have a simple but confronting exercise. One, write down what you need to feel safe. Not luxurious, safe. Roof, food, health, rest. Two, then write down what you'd like to do when you're no longer chasing. Time with kids, writing, building, surfing, serving. Three, now ask, how much does that life cost? And that's a good exercise. Wouldn't most people would probably come to the conclusion that it doesn't cost that much, right?
I think when you really define it, your costs are lower. And a lot of the panic and stress that you're worried about, you realize it was unfounded and it was your mind just rambling on, not focused. Yes. And if you're focused on what's important, not a luxurious home, not a massive home, you got roof, you got food, your health, like then all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm doing well because you've written down what's important to you. You're not looking, God, that neighbor just got $150,000 car. Oh, they're taking another trip to, you're like, I'm living the life I wanted. And that's where you start to get peace, because you can't have peace with something if you haven't defined it. What is peace to you? Great relationships, going to bed at night knowing, you know, I get to wake up the next day and I have food on my table and I get to work out and both my legs work and arms and I can surf. Like that's where you start to get this inner peace. And once you have inner peace, you can actually tend to be better at what you do because you're focused on what's important, not all this external noise around you, like in the market, your attention's all like, oh, they're doing this and Mary's doing that. And she got, and then you're losing your coin.
Okay. And there's some more good, there's the essays explore some more of that topic of social comparison and why that's so insidious. And there's some good questions in there. And actually, I'm going to tell people to go read the book because, again, it's a short book. And everyone should, if you're a thoughtful kind of person, which you are, if you're listening to the Limitless podcast, you should read a book or two on personal finance every year.
Yeah,
you know you should. So in the essays on this one, you'll find some more good self-knowledge kind of questions to explore. Next, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the Good Judgment Project and your work. What is the science of super forecasting?
It's always fascinated me. People go on TV, they make bold predictions week after week, day after day, and no one ever goes back and fact checks them. You've seen this. You'll have someone come on, especially sports. They'll say, they're going to win this. They're going to do this. I would go back and I'd look at the beginning of the year and I'd said, you picked, you know, 10 teams to make the playoffs. One did. And then you did that wrong. 10 years in a row. Why do you have the label expert if you can only hit one out of 10 times the target? Because when we go to school, we're graded. And if someone got a 10% and someone got a 90%, you wouldn't cheat off the person with the 10%. You'd focus on that. And in an argument, they'd say, well, everybody makes mistakes. You're like, well, yeah, but you make 90% and he makes 10. That's just fascinating me, because it bothered me that people would be so loud yet be so wrong. Often wrong, seldom in doubt. And in my business, there's three areas: politics, financial, and sports, where people just constantly make predictions. It's just the way it is. And they'll say, this stock will be this. And then I would look and I would go through, and the analyst had been wrong 92% of the time. The biggest bank in the world, JP Morgan, with the best financial researchers, predicted a negative year in 2024. The market was up 21%. Why would I want advice from them? If I did what they said, I would have lost 30%. To me, I want to know who's good and who's bad. So I just got into it because I wanted to see, can I do it? It's not about your IQ as much as it is about your EQ and your JQ, your emotional and your judgment, your judgments. And that's what has always fascinated me. The mental models of not allowing external forces to sway you has always been a big thing to me. And then how to make the best buys. Warren Buffett is an example. He's not emotional about things. He would go in and buy things at depressed values and they would go up, but he had to buy it when no one else liked it. And so that goes against the grain of life. So to answer your question, I was fascinated. I've taken their courses and I joined it, and it's gotten me better. Everything has an outside view and an inside view. Most people just look really closely and they don't look at the outside view, all of the other factors that you can't control. And historically, which is going to blow your mind on this, I think, a great CEO only affects a company 60% of the time, just barely more than a coin flip. A great CEO was not going to save Blockbuster with Netflix. A great CEO was not going to save BlackBerry when Apple iPhone came out. You know what I mean? Like, there are things just out of your control. So there's a lot of things that are just luck, too. And that part of randomness also has to be in it. But you can continually update your forecast and start to really hone in stuff. But you're constantly looking outside, not just, oh, that's a smart guy. Well, that doesn't really mean anything. Mark Cuban, who does the show, God, I forgot the name of it.
Shark Tank.
Yes. Like, he hasn't had any of them work out. But people would say he's a smart guy. He would have a knack for that. And he doesn't, because it's not easy to do that. A lot of that happened to be, he was 20 years old writing code when he founded the company, which happened to be at the right time in the late 90s when people were just buying anything possible because they thought it would go up. So there's a lot more to it than just being smart. There's a lot of luck involved. So forecasting, you have to take a lot of that into account, because everybody had a forecast. Russia invades Ukraine. And now that might have been a high probability, but then what happened with oil prices? You know, there are things outside and you just take that as understanding. But it is fun because they track it, they measure you against other people, and then you know how you're doing. And that's when you start to say, wow, I'm improving. I'm looking, I'm making adjustments. And you have to constantly do it, or you just don't stay sharp. It's like running. You can't not run and then 3 months later or 3 years later run like you did. It's a constant treadmill. And
I'm curious, okay, from a longevity perspective, what are you doing to maintain your forecasting aptitude, to fortify that against the inevitable effects of time?
All right. I don't really forecast more than a year out. It's highly improbable. What I forecast, I'll forecast oil, gold, treasuries, the CPI, the jobs numbers, things that matter in my field, I will have fun and do like the MVP of the football league here and some things like that. Because, and I actually got it right a couple of years ago. I got Lamar right. And like, it's because you have to realize that everybody goes after the most well-known name, but regression to mean happens in all fields. Regression to mean is a statistical fact of life. People have great years and it's really hard to maintain it. You know, like when you're learning, Jonathan, you're reading, you have really good days. You're like, oh my God, I, and then you have some bad days. And then, yeah, you might be going slowly up, but you have these bumps. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't take human frailty or fallibility into things. Like you might just have a couple bad games because you're going through stuff or your kid's falling on your leg or whatever, and you're distracted more than other times or whatever the case. But you have to look at the human component. And often we look at them as just a number, but you got to look at the noise and human nature. It's very hard to be perfect every day. That's why golfers who can golf so well, you know, they ebb and flow and can be wide ranging. And the same with shooters. They'll make 20 shots in a row and then miss 20 shots in a row. They're still shooting 50%.
Okay. All right. I have an off the wall question for you as we draw to our conclusion here. How would you profit or protect wealth if you could verify the veracity of anything instantly about the present world? Like, if you had the magical ability to verify the veracity of claims made by governments or corporations, not things about the future, but things about the present and the past.
Okay. Let me see if I can answer this. Here's what I'm forecasting for a recession. Historically, when unemployment rises, you have to figure out why. And it is rising. And it was because the majority of jobs or GDP growth is tied to job growth. And you can't have job growth with a declining population. And in the U.S., immigration was a major factor. We kept getting new people in. You can create more jobs. So when you take immigrants away, 1.2 million away, the U.S. will have a negative year-over-year population rate. It's never happened before. So right there, if you're making a forecast on today's data, you can, obviously, you don't know if the government's being 100% honest on this, so you use multiple factors, you're trying to use different things. That would tell you it's going to be very hard to grow when your population's decreased. And that's why Japan really, it took 35 years because their low birth rate means the population never grew.
Mm-hmm.
And with China having the one child policy, that's called their GDP can't keep going faster because they don't have people replacing the people at the replacement rate you need. And that's what happened with. So that's one area that you can look at all these factors and you may not have an exact number, but you can know the G in GDP oftentimes is people. And if we have high immigration, we have higher GDP, which is why we had the highest GDP of like the G20 nations, essentially, because people were coming here, okay, could find a job and they would work hard. So that's one area that you can trust the data in a sense, because you can get a sense of it. They're reporting different things and sense like that. When you find out farmers don't have people showing up to work, that's going to hurt the GDP because the cows aren't getting milked, blueberries aren't getting picked. Slaughterhouses aren't because they don't have the people. So you can look at the payrolls on that and get a reasonable thing because ADP and Paychex are private companies as well. All right. So to kind of go on that, if there's what's called money supply, every dollar the U.S. makes or increases or decreases is trackable. You can't really fudge that number because it's a universal world. If the money supply is going up, and rates are being cut, that will cause inflation. You don't want money supply to increase while GDP is decreasing. That is a statistical thing. There's like a 96% correlation to that. So I don't necessarily have to know exactly what the money supply number is, but if I'm looking at a quarterly and it's going up and rates are being cut, I can then make a forecast on that. And so, and also for every dollar the U.S. that leaves the U.S. and goes to the euro, you're trusting the other governments because, you know, you can, it's all trackable digital. So there's no loss in that type of data. And when China sells goods to the U.S. or the Europe, we track all that. So there's a lot of stuff that can't be fudged. You know, if you sell 100 widgets, we know because they came to our port and came in. So there's a lot of things that we can track and we don't have to worry about governments lying and stuff like that. There are obviously things that they can lie, but that's how you start to look at the outside view of all these things to make a tight view inside, if I'm answering your question correctly. So there's a lot of data that just can't be fudged. And you look at that and then you know the formula that there might be an 80% chance of this or only a 10% chance. But I think the group as a whole is like 80% inflation will be higher because money supply increases. It's like flooding the place with tons of money, but you're declining. So there's all this money and that it raises inflation. So there's a lot of negative things I think are happening that are inevitable that people don't want to address because also they're fearful of retribution from the leader of our country right now. If they go and say it, he'll tweet, "You're dumb. You don't know what you're talking about. Fake news. Yeah. Never heard of the guy. He's a loser. He was a coffee boy for me," whatever the case.
Was that an accusation thrown on Truth Social?
One guy, he goes, "Never met the guy. I think he got me coffee one day." And there's like 500 pictures of him hanging out with the guy. Never seen him before. He might have got me coffee once. I mean, my point is that there are enough things in place where you can track Korea, all these other governments and monies and things like that and interest rates and make really good decisions, even if you don't necessarily trust what our government, the people running it may do. You can trust the data that you have now will be accurate. And I think that's what I try to focus on. And not get caught up in what people say, but I get caught up in where the money goes. And money tells you the truth. You know this. Mm-hmm. You have people that will say, definitely do this. And you're like, well, do you eat the food there? No, I don't eat the food there. You're like, well, what are you telling me to do that for? You know, if you're doing it, I'm more likely to do it because I follow the big money. So right now the euro is getting higher. And going up in value versus the dollar. So that tells me, regardless of any politics, that people, when they sell something to the U.S., they're taking their money back and switching it to the euro rather than keeping it here because they don't feel as safe. And if you don't feel as safe, you're not going to keep as much money here. It doesn't mean you pull all the money out because you can't because of money supply. But you can. You start to see these trails of money leaving and you're like, he's telling me he's keeping it here, but he just move 200 billion out. I think I'm going to go with where the money's going. You know what I mean? You're not going to just sit. And so if I'm answering your question, the stoicism allows me to really look at it and not get emotional, like, oh, this sucks. It's hurting my country. The stoicism says I need to focus on what's happening, be present, and then make decisions that are going to be beneficial. Because I think in 6 months or a year, when things are cheaper, you're going to now have to have the psychology and the stoic approach to be able to buy things that are really beat up. As an example, Spotify was growing rapidly during the recession in 2022. I mean, you saw it. Spotify's 600 million and 900 million, but the stock was going down. And the question is, you might cancel some of your additional services, but most people love music when they're going through challenging times. So to me, I mean, you know, music peps us up, makes us feel no one's going to cancel their $10 Spotify. They'll cancel their $20 subscription for other stuff. So that's where you look and you say, oh, I'm going to buy this because I think it's a great buy at 100. Now it's like 700. Those are like the things where you make you avoid the emotional component of it coming down and you invest because you're looking at the logical component and you're forecasting that people will continue to like music in the future and do it on their phones.
Yeah, that seems like a good buy. So yes. I'll reemphasize the point that I made earlier, which is that, dear listener, you should be reading a couple of personal finance books every year. And I think enough equation belongs on that reading list. So you'll be able to find it on the show notes page for this episode on limitlessmindset.com. And, oh, I should tell my surfing story.
Please, so, I got the advice.
Yeah, I am a bad surfer. I can guarantee you I'm not on your level. But when I first moved to Costa Rica, my buddy that I lived with there would take me surfing every day. And he would mostly, he gave me just minimal instruction to get barely competent surfing on a shortboard. So I'd paddle out there, pop up, have a little bit of fun. I loved it, even being awful. And then I was in Dominical, Costa Rica.
Okay.
Near San Manuel Antonio Park.
Okay, you're way down south. Okay, got it.
Yep. And then my friends there urged me to get a surf lesson. And there's a guy there who is he's the local surf instructor / reggae singer in a band / small time drug dealer.
That sounds about right for Costa Rica.
Yep. Pura vida.
Pura vida.
We met him at a couple of parties. So I was like, yeah, sure. I'll do a surf lesson with Rama. So he picks me up and we go to the beach, just the two of us. And we start, you know, in the sand, just practicing the pop-up form in the sand. And almost immediately, he starts to get pretty irritated with my incompetence. with me, I'm here in paradise. I looked at a beautiful bird, I think, and he got irritated with me for not paying as much attention to him as I should have been. And this guy got so angry with me in a surfing lesson that he abandoned me. This is what he did. He gave me a longboard, and I was totally unaccustomed to longboards. So I did a really crappy job of maneuvering the longboard out there on a second break. And he got so irritated with me that he just left me for about 45 minutes. Jeez. And went and surfed on his own, being the expert that he was, while I struggled with that longboard. And then we came back to the beach, and he was still just as angry with me, sucking down his cigarette, yelling at me. That was the last time in my life that I said to myself, I am just about to get in a fight. Like, this guy is just about to punch me. He was that angry with me.
That's crazy.
But eventually he tranquiloed some, and we went back to the lodge where I was staying. But that was a really unexpected surf lesson experience.
That is, because normally people are really calm. They realize you're going to have to teach people things, and they're not going to pick it up quite quickly, and it typically causes a lot of headaches for someone who is impatient. And that sounds like he's not designed for surf coaching. Maybe reggae and would be better at it, or in his other occupation.
Yeah. He should have smoked a little bit more of something before that.
Yes.
Surf. That's surf. I said. Well, it's been a pleasure, Will. Please stick around after we close out here.
Okay.
I'm Jonathan with Limitless Mindset, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.